This is 1330 WRCA Watertown, Boston, a Beasley Broadcast Group station.
This is Tube Talk on WRCA Radio. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Ho, ho, ho. Ha, ha, ha. Hee, hee, hee. You think the laugh's on me? They all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round. They all laughed when Edison recorded sound. They all laughed at Wilbur and his brother when they said that man could fly. They told Marconi wireless was a phony. It's the same old cry. They laughed at me wanting you. Said I was reaching for the moon. But all you came through. Now they'll have to change their tune. They all said we never could be happy. They laughed at us and how. But ho, 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 who's got the last laugh now?
Were too high to climb, but people from Missouri never incensed me. Oh, I wasn't a bit concerned, for from history I had learned how many, many times the worm had turned. They all laughed at Rockefeller Center, now they're fighting to get in. They all laughed at Whitney and his cotton gin. They all laughed at Fulton and his steamboat, Hershey and his chocolate bar. Ford and his Lizzie kept the laughers busy. That's how people are. They laughed at me wanting you. Said it would be hello, goodbye. But all you came through. Now they're eating humble pie. They all said we'd never get together. Darling, let's take a bow. For ho, 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 who's got the last laugh? And what a last laugh. Who's got the last laugh now?
Mr. Song and Dance, Mr. Fred Astaire, one of my favorites. If you listen to the show, you know we're fond of Mr. Fred. Great song. I wonder if they're laughing at me. You know, you heard him say they laughed at Marconi. If they could laugh at him, they could be laughing at me. But I'm going to try not to get paranoid. Thanks for joining us. This is Tube Talk. If you like good radio conversation, swell music, interesting guests, this is the place to hang out. We have it all right here on 1330 AM WRCA.
Come on in.
Oh, my honey, better hurry and let's meander. Ain't you going to the leader man, ragged leader man? Oh, my honey, let me take you to Alexander's grandstand, red band. Ain't you coming along? Come on here, come on here. Alexander's ragtime band. Come on here, it's the best band in the land. They can play a bugle like you never heard before. That's the natural that you want to go to war. That's just the bestest band, what am honey land. Come on along, come on along. Let me take you by the hand up to the man who's the leader of the band.
If you want to hear that swanny music played in ragtime,
come on here, come on here, come on here, Alexander's ragtime band. Come on here, come on here. Come on here, Alexander's ragtime band.
Come
like you never heard before. Simple natural that you want to go to war.
That's just the best man, what am, honey lamb.
Come on along, let me take you by the hand. Up to the man, up to the man, who's the leader of the band.
And that's the Boswell Sisters doing Alexander's Ragtime Band. This is Tube Talk on WRCA Radio. Here I am. I'm all brill creamed. I got my shoes shined. I'm wearing my vintage blue Zenith radio repair smock, and we're here for you. And we hope you're sitting around a nice, well-lit dial light on your favorite RCA, Philco, Zenith, or the like, sitting all comfy and cozy in that big overstuffed chair and... like the one I have here, it's the one the cat rips. You're probably getting tired of hearing about my cat, huh? Anyway, what a life sitting in front of that dial. The nice, gentle glow. What a way to spend the evening. And we appreciate you for spending it here with us.
At Word Poetic, I'm so pathetic that I always have found it best. Instead of getting them off my chest, to let them rest unexpressed. I hate parading my serenading, for I'll probably miss the part. But if this ditty is not so pretty, at least it'll tell you how great you are. You're the top. You're Mahatma Gandhi. You're the top. You're Napoleon Brandy. You're the purple light of a summer night in Spain. You're the National Gallery. You're Gobble's salary. You're cellophane. You're sublime. You're a turkey dinner. You're the time of the Derby winner. I'm a toy balloon that's faded soon to pop. But a baby, I'm the bottom, you're the top.
Merman, and she was the top, wasn't she? Let me tell you, if I had a set of pipes like that, I wouldn't even need a microphone and a radio station to do this program. My name is Paul Burish. I am your friendly purveyor of radio patter here on Tube Talk. Well, we're thrilled to have Cam Trowbridge with us, author of Marconi, father of wireless, grandfather of radio, great-grandfather of the cell phone, the story of the race to control the long-distance wireless. And Cam, thanks for being on. Thanks for taking the time. I'm just going to read a little description of your book here, which folks, if they are interested in checking it out or even purchasing it, can find right on Amazon. But let me give a little book description here. Not until Marconi has there been an in-depth biography that focuses on the inventor as a businessman, entrepreneur, and the global race that took place in an effort to dominate and control wireless technology. From the end of the Victorian era to the First World War, Marconi would take center stage as he perfected the science of sending signals over longer and longer distances. As a result of Marconi's first electrical triumph at the age of 21, he gained ever-increasing attention from powerful interests, including governments who sought to obtain the keys to the new science. Marconi, the father of radio and radar, would create an industry-dominating enterprise that would last for over a quarter century, utilizing important, though little-used documents. Arthur Calvin D. Trowbridge has brought a new perspective to the scientific life and business times of Guglielmo Marconi. So we appreciate you being on. And, you know, from what I know about Marconi, he was born fairly well off in Italy, but had an incredible knack for being a scientist and a businessman. And maybe you could give us a little background on how he really got the ball rolling in the world of wireless.
Well, thank you, Paul. I'd be happy to do that. Marconi had a mixed upbringing. His father was Italian. His mother was Irish. Actually, she was Annie Jameson of the Jameson whiskey family in Ireland. And she actually eloped with his father once she reached her majority because her parents objected to her marrying somebody who'd already been married once. He was a widower. He had a child. He was a Catholic. Jamesons were, I guess we'd call them Episcopalians here, Church of England there.
Scandalous.
At home, they spoke a Bolognese Italian dialect, but when he traveled with his mother, which was often, they spoke English. And his father was very severe. He was a farmer. He wanted Marconi to be a farmer. He had absolutely no use for Marconi's experiments, and became so exasperated that he frequently would break them up when he came across them on the farm, whereas Marconi's mother doted on him. She was her baby, her youngest son, and so there was this inherent conflict. He was homeschooled until he went to high school, and he had 3 years of technical school, and that's where he acquired his learning in electricity. And of course, electricity was a very new science then. Edison had only been around for a little while. Bell had just invented the telephone. So there was a great deal that wasn't understood and a great deal to learn. But Marconi did not graduate, apparently, from the technical school. He did not get in the Naval Academy where his father wanted him to go. He did not get into the local University of Bologna outside of his home. So he came home at 19. No job, no career, no interest in being a farmer, harangued by his father who thought he was a useless failure at age 19 or 20. And so here was somebody who was bright, was well-trained in a new art, very much like the Silicon Valley technical people in many ways. That's
yeah,
going on
I was
going to
say, sounds like a, you know, a Bill Gates type, you know, dropped out of school, but he sure turned it around, huh?
He certainly turned it around. He was inspired because he read about a German professor who had sent a wireless across his laboratory, 3 feet. He sent an electric current without a wire, and Marconi understood immediately that he, if he could harness that electricity, could send messages through the air without wires. And that was an inspiration at age 20 that lasted his entire lifetime. That's all he ever wanted to do from then on.
So that German would be Hertz if we're playing on Jeopardy?
That's right. Exactly. That's where it came from.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. And when you explain his mother's heritage, it explains why he was able to connect when he was doing ship-to-shore type experiments with the English government and the English Navy was very keen on harnessing this technology to keep in touch with their fleet and to create ship-to-shore communications.
Well, that's exactly what happened. He offered his invention to the Italian Bureau of Posts and Telegraphs, but they said, who needs wireless? We're already covered with telegraphs. So So his mother's cousin was in London, and he was a commodity broker. And he said, come to London. And he introduced Marconi to the right people. And as things progressed with the English Navy, he raised the money. So Marconi had a startup, high-tech, attic-based venture, just like our silicone companies today.
Yeah, and it's an interesting story, too, in that, you know, back in it's you have to really put yourself back in time, in the period, and understand, as you were saying, electricity is new. Edison is viewed as, you know, half mad, half genius. And
right.
Here's somebody who says, I'm actually going to send communications through the air, no wires, and this to a society that, you know, thought, well, you know, much like we do with the gasoline car, the telegraph is irreplaceable. It's never going to go away.
And it was very, very exciting. When Marconi first wirelessed the message across the English Channel, it caught the world's imagination. He got letters from people in Japan. A Japanese woman wrote him and said his wireless tickled her feet.
Wow.
And in those days, of course, there weren't baseball stars and basketball stars. There wasn't television. And Marconi, the worldwide celebratory, and he was probably the most interviewed man in the world at one point. He was as well known as kings, popes, and generals.
No, it's when we were chatting a little bit before, you know, I was asking to be on the show, I mentioned that we're fortunate here in Massachusetts, being right, you know, outside of Boston. Down in Wellfleet, we have what's left of the Marconi site, which right now is really just nothing more than some bricks and some timbers and some chains that, you know, the towers that he had the antenna strung on were changed. It's just really the flotsam and the jetsam, and it's right on the bluff. The ocean has eaten into it and eaten into it. And I don't know if when you were presenting your talk down in Chatham, if you had a chance to get up there. But you go down to Wellfleet, and you stand on that bluff, and you see the remnants of his station, and you look across the Atlantic, and you think about transmitting the message from President Roosevelt over to the King of England, and you close your eyes and you think about it, and, you know, from what I've heard, the spark gap generator that was used was so loud, I mean, you could hear it a mile down the road from where he was in Wellfleet, and you put yourself back in time and you just kind of say, wow, you know, you just marvel at that type of an accomplishment, and it really was the type of thing that would make somebody an instant celebrity, I guess, in that time.
Yeah, that's amazing, and, you know, when you think about it, there is not a single obstruction between South Wellfleet and England, which is why they chose it, because they didn't want any obstacles. They didn't really understand what they were doing, how it worked, whether it went through the earth, over the earth, bounced. And so the best they could do was say, well, at least not have any obstructions. Now, South Wellfleet, which you're talking about, of course, is where the world's first transatlantic signal occurred from Marconi, but very nearby in Chatham, there is a station that he built to establish a worldwide network only 14 years later, and that's there's an absolutely wonderful Chatham-Marconi Communication Museum down there, and that is the actual building. They've restored it, and they have all kinds of exhibits down there. You can look at Marconi's equipment, or you can see what a wonderful role that station played in World War II, zeroing in on U-boats that were right off our coast. So the South Wellfleet is very interesting to visit, and if somebody wants to do that, they really would have a marvelous time stopping in at the Chatham Museum.
You know, anybody who goes down to Cape Cod for a summer break and runs into even if it isn't a rainy day, it sounds like it's a worthwhile take, because Chatham really isn't that far from Wellfleet either. And, you know, I guess one of the bigger events of that era, and what brought an awful lot of acclaim to Marconi, to the invention, and to, you know, who's a peripheral character at this point in time, David Sarnoff, is the Titanic going down, and maybe you can discuss that a little bit for our audience as far as the Marconi wireless and its impact on saving the few folks who did get saved from the Titanic and the type of world sensation that created.
Well, Marconi and his wife were scheduled to be on the Titanic. His operators, he had two operators.
Interesting.
On the ship, and his wireless was on the ship, and he was scheduled to go on it, except that his biggest U.S. rival, United Wireless, went into bankruptcy just before then, and he decided to acquire United Wireless. But the American Marconi Company's shareholder meeting was just 2 days after the Titanic was scheduled to arrive in New York, and he thought maybe if the Titanic got delayed, he wouldn't be able to get there on time. And, of course, his wife said to him that the captain would never allow the Titanic to be late on such an important voyage. But unfortunately, her child came down with the flu just the day before she was supposed to go, so both of them missed being on the Titanic. And as you said, the Titanic wireless was what alerted other ships in the area to the fact that the Titanic was sinking, and that's why they were able to send ships. They got there about 5 or 6 hours after the Titanic went down. One of the Marconi wireless operators died when they wireless until the very end and abandoned ship just minutes before it actually sank. One survived and one went down. But I think you were also alluding to David Sarnoff, who was a Marconi employee, and he is supposed to have been at the wireless station in the Wanamaker building in New York, manning the station when he picked up the distress signals. Now, that's very controversial. You probably know more about the controversy than I do as to whether Sarnoff was actually there.
Well, given his personality, I think folks have always had in the back of the head that you know, he, while he was certainly working for them at the time, that may have been a little bit of self-promotion as he started to build you know, his own myth and legacy and try to build himself as you know, build himself up as a real pioneer. And you know, another thing that's kind of interesting, and I just was, you know, as you were discussing the wireless operators, one of whom went down with the ship, you know, just we have that Costa cruise ship that went down off of Italy, and here's the captain getting off, you know, in advance.
Right.
You know, and on the Titanic back in those days, it was the, you know, women and children first, the band is playing, you know, and again, you know, what exactly happened, you know, is somewhat of a point of conjecture, but yet they were sending the wireless signal right up until the ship actually went under the water, and a great testament to the wireless service, which was a good way to make a living, too. Apparently, from what I understand, there were a lot of folks who cut their teeth in radio, becoming wireless operators, working on various types of ships, some small, some large, and it was a service that was, if you had a good fist and you were very capable, you were in demand and you could make some money, and it was a very exciting vocation for people to make a career in radio.
And the hams, of course, were growing up at the same time. They were using Marconi equipment. They could make their own sets, and they were very instrumental in establishing the next generation of wireless. The wireless Marconi used was long waves, and the result of the Titanic sinking, because they all got on the airways and jammed the signals that were trying to be sent by the Navy and other people in the rescue effort, they passed an act immediately and banned the ham operators from operating on long waves, thinking that the short waves were totally useless, and this way they would get rid of the hams and the interference. But the hams continued to experiment and actually sent signals before anybody else did across the Atlantic on shortwave.
Now, what exactly transpired? I mean, obviously, the Titanic disaster comes and goes, and it's a huge historic event. What does it do for the Marconi company? I mean, obviously, he's experienced a great degree of success, but does this really solidify the Marconi company, you know, in their hold on providing ship-to-shore equipment for various governments and navies?
Well, two things happened at once. He was already, at the time of the Titanic sinking, the principal wireless company in Europe, but United Wireless, who I mentioned earlier that he acquired out of bankruptcy, was much larger, maybe 10 times larger than Marconi, with the largest U.S. company. So the combination of acquiring U.S. Wireless and the new rules put on ships by the Radio Act, which required every ship over a certain size to have two radio operators, just exploded the market. And Marconi, within a year of the Titanic sinking, was the world's dominant wireless company, and he continued that way right up until the end of World War One. At the end of World War One, the Navy saw how important long-term wireless, transatlantic over-the-water wireless was, and the British controlled all of the undersea cable cable communication, and Marconi, who was actually a British company, controlled the wireless, and the United States said, we just can't have this. We have to participate. So they went to the Marconi company and said, we're not going to grant you licenses to operate wireless from U.S. shores, so why don't you sell your company? And General Electric said, we will create a subsidiary called the Radio Corporation of America, or RCA, and we will buy your assets. So the Marconi company reluctantly parted with its American assets, and RCA came into existence, and David Sarnoff, who wasn't top officer but a principal officer of RCA, went with the RCA company, and then, of course, you know the story very well about Sarnoff and RCA.
Yeah, it's an amazing, you know, just another fellow who uses that, you know, building block that Marconi created as a launching pad, and certainly not only was Sarnoff instrumental in putting, you know, his quote-unquote radio music box idea into most homes in America, but just the company that was RCA, and, you know, I guess in the 50s, they were, you know, in relative terms, dollars, it sounds small today, but I guess at one point they had sales somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, $580 million and employed 40, 50,000 people in all the different facets, from their broadcast business and recording businesses and research business and the tube manufacturer and the equipment manufacturer. Just a huge juggernaut that got launched, and, you know, all would have been impossible without Marconi getting things started. When you were writing the book and doing your research, what did you find? Were there anything that you found, that you discovered, that you were surprised by or isn't really common knowledge, or you didn't think, you know, it didn't quite fit in what your, you know, your preconceptions might have been about Marconi? What interesting things did you find out? Because I'm certain you spent an awful lot of time looking at a lot of documents.
Well, I found a couple of things. One was, though he's been thought of as an inventor or a scientist, he was as good a businessman as he was a scientist, because he created this industry, and he went on, as I said, after acquiring United Wireless, to actually dominate it. And then after World War One, after he lost his U.S. assets, following on the experiments of the hams, he created shortwaves. And he revolutionized the industry again, and his shortwaves were so cost-effective that they threatened to bankrupt all the other wireless companies and the cable companies. So, again, he was in a position of domination. The British government then, which didn't want the cable companies bankrupt, forced him to merge into the cable companies in a minority position. So he lost control of his company because of his great scientific advance. But the point I was making was that Marconi twice dominated the industry that he had created, and he remained an officer, a principal officer of the company during the whole time. Now, Bell and Edison, who were also brilliant inventors, did not stay with their company, so they weren't businessmen. So yeah. I think that Marconi is comparable to somebody you mentioned earlier, which is Bill Gates, and also to Steve Jobs, because he created these tremendous concepts in technology, or programming in their case, and then as a business manager, he stayed and ran the company.
Yeah,
I think that was the biggest thing I discovered.
Yeah, it's a very rare breed to have somebody who has both the scientific skills as well as the entrepreneurial and the business skills. It's, you know, so often you hear of inventors who get fleeced by people who have stolen their ideas, or, you know, let them, you know, squander their money and take over their intellectual capital and run with it, or vice versa. You hear of somebody who's a great businessman and organizer, but just never quite has the idea. He never has the ability to really grasp what the business he's trying to promote or build is all about. And he's, you know, just never gets that massive success. And for Marconi to be at the top of the charts, so to speak, in two separate instances, you know, it's an amazing accomplishment. And, you know, the other parallel that I would draw is, you know, we talk about radio being the first information superhighway, even though it was, you know, a small and probably dusty little road compared to what we call the information superhighway today. I mean, think about World War II, the first major world conflict that was actually broadcast. You know, not only all the communications between the troops and the various services, but to be broadcast to the populace. And again, without Marconi laying that groundwork early in those teens and 20s, none of that would have occurred, and World War II would have been a very entirely different conflict, don't you think?
Yes, I think that's right. And you asked me what other things I learned that were a surprise. The second thing was what rough competitors the governments were, because he not only had to compete with scientists in Germany, France, and the United States, but the British Navy, who wanted his wireless, actually copied it without telling him and manufactured them. Then the United States Navy, because it saw how important it was in World War One, forced him to sell to RCA. He had the only radio station in Great Britain, and the British didn't want a lot of stations on the air because the country's so small there would have been so much interference.
Sure.
That they didn't think they could manage it, so they forced his assets into British Broadcasting Corporation. So he's really the founder of BBC. And then, as I said, at the end of the day, because the British government didn't want their cable investments jeopardized by a private company controlling them, they forced him to merge into a minority position in cable and wireless. So the very success and strategic importance of his inventions led governments to take very hostile, aggressive actions against him.
Well, certainly in those days, too, you know, the British were predominant on so many fronts. They viewed that as another tool to help, you know, reinforce and keep their dominance, especially of the sea routes and the superiority of their navy. So I'm sure they were, to say, a little bit vicious about the whole thing would probably be an understatement. How long a life did Marconi live? How old was he when he passed away, Cam?
Well, he was born in 1874, and he died in 1937. So I think that makes about 63 years old.
And what was the state of his business and the Marconi Company when he passed away, or what was then the Marconi Company when he passed away in 1937?
Well, he'd already lost it. The American assets were then called RCA.
Correct.
The radio assets were called BBC, and the rest of his company was called Cable and Wireless, and he did not have a controlling position. As a matter of fact, when Cable and Wireless merger occurred, they broke up the Marconi Wireless Company into several divisions, and they didn't even give Marconi a management position. They put him into a research subdivision about three corporate layers from the top.
Sort of a sad end to somebody who had done so much to build an industry, and actually build it, it sounds like, twice almost in his lifetime. But an amazing story
really,
for somebody who
was
63
years old. The business tragedy, because I think a tragedy is when your very best efforts, and you do very well, lead to your downfall.
It's ironic, and again, you wonder how many people would have, you know, survived in it as long as he did, given the fact that in those days, I think business rights and lawyers and civil liberties, and I think you were probably much more at the mercy, as you were pointing out, of the various governments who were really calling the shots on a lot of this. It probably wouldn't be an easy thing to take the British Empire to court in those days.
I don't think so. But I think you're right. I think there are a lot more protections today than there were then, and the battles would have been much more long and drawn out and maybe not successful on behalf of the governments.
Well, we'd just like to remind the audience, this is Tube Talk on WRCA 1330 AM. We're speaking with Calvin Cam Trowbridge, who has spent 40 years in the corporate field observing, analyzing, managing, and writing about international legal and financial affairs. And he's been a graduate from Phillips Exeter, which is up in this neck of the woods, and Yale and Harvard Law School. We're over in Central Square. I'm sure you know where that is if you went to Harvard Law. And, you know, also has a great love for radio and has written a wonderful book on Marconi. How did you get interested in radio yourself? We'll take a little sidebar here and just ask, how did you get an interest in radio? Are you an active ham or an antique collector, or how did you get started
interested? I read when Marconi was 19 years old and he was up in the attic of the family farm where his grandfather was raising silkworms, and there he was working 724. Trying to make this wireless experiment to work. And the more I read about him, the more fascinated I became. And I didn't think anybody else had written a biography that covered his business side as well as his science side.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it. And I have a little publication I think the National Park Service put out, and I gave it to my son and he was looking at it, and I was trying to get him to equate what it really was and how it. What has it turned into? And one of the things we had mentioned as well is, Marconi had an awful lot of vision. And, now we all go around and, you sit on the train or you're driving in your car. Everybody's on their cell phone. Everybody's sending a text message. Everybody has a smartphone. And he did envision individual wireless communications devices and has quoted as mentioning these as possibilities and eventualities in the future. So, I mean, it really shows you he was a great thinker and visionary as well as somebody who could get the business done at the time.
Well, I think you're right. He did say at one point that he envisioned a handheld point-to-point communication system. So he may not have had the exact picture and all the multiple programs that can be run off of these cell phones and smartphones today, but he certainly understood what was possible.
And, as we sit here today, which, for anybody who's keeping up on the news, as we all wait, and I guess it's landed, the large solar ejection has come our way and landed against our electromagnetic field. So, I'm still in the radio station, and everything seems to be working. We're talking with Cam, and he still seems to be getting through to us here on the radio station. So I guess we dodged a bullet, but, those things sometimes bode well for interesting ionospheric conditions. So anybody who's into radio and shortwave and long-distance AM listening, the next few days should be fun. So where can we find the book? I know it's on Amazon. Is it in bookstores as well, Cam?
It's in bookstores. Bookstores can order it for you if they don't actually carry it in inventory. The Chatham Marconi Center down there in Chatham, they have copies right on hand. So it's generally and easily available for anybody who would like to read it.
And where it has such a lengthy title to it, you could always go in and put in Cam Trowbridge and Marconi into Google, and I'm sure the book would come up, and you can also find some interesting little articles, some of the various organizations that Cam has gone out to and spoken about Marconi and talked about his book and talked about the relevance that Marconi has to our modern life. Make for interesting reading as well. So, Cam, I just wanted to say thanks an awful lot for being on Tube Talk. We appreciate it, and I'm going to read the book.
Oh, great, Bob. It's a pleasure to meet you. It's always fun to talk to somebody who's so knowledgeable.
Thanks again, and take care. Have a good one. A delightful little musical interlude from Henry Mancini. Thanks again for tuning in to Tube Talk. Though I know there are many people who would tell you radio is dead, we're here to say nay, nay. Not only do we listen to radio, we listen with the glorious radios of old. We are dedicated to their preservation and continued use. They are time capsules full of interesting technology for us to still enjoy. And preserving this heritage is our reason for being. And, you know, I would advise you, as public service announcement here, if you like to listen to good music, doesn't it sound nice on that antique set? And how much email and texting can the mind take? So here in the cozy radio parlor, we relax and chat and listen to the fine music. I would encourage you to turn in those cold, clammy LED displays for a nice, warm dial light on a classic tube radio. You'll be glad you did.
The way you wear your hair, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me. The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me. We may never, never meet again on the bumpy road to love. Still I'll always, always keep the memory of the way you hold your knife, the way we dance till three, the way you've changed my life. No, no, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away.
Mildred Bailey and her orchestra. We appreciate your tuning in tonight to Tube Talk on WRCA Radio, 1330 AM on the broadcast band and over the internet. If you'd like to reach the show, if you have a guest you'd like to suggest, if you have an interesting topic you'd like to have us cover, if you'd like to share with us a story of a great radio find or a difficult restoration project you've completed, we'd love to hear from you. If you'd just like to give us some feedback on the show, we'd still love to hear from you. Our email address is tubetalk1@gmail.com. TubeTalk, @gmail.com.
How glad the many millions of Tom and Dick and Harry's would be to capture me. But you were so persistent, you wore out my resistance. I fell, and it was swell. You're my big and brave and handsome Romeo. How I've won you, I will never, never know. It's not that you're attractive, but oh, my heart grew active when you came into view. I've got a crush on you, sweetie pie, all the day and night time. Hear me sigh. That I could fall, so much emotion. Could you coo? Could you care for a cunning cottage we could share? The world will pardon my much, 'cause I we could share. The world will pardon my much, 'cause I have got a crush, my baby, on you.
That was Lee Wiley with I've Got a Crush on You. Thanks for joining us here. We hope you've enjoyed some interesting conversation. Yes, some witty banter. And we hope you've enjoyed the finest in independently produced radio. Yes, you've truly reached the zenith here at Tube Talk. Thanks again for listening. Oh no, here we go again.
I am a little tiny bird. My name is Tweety Pie. I live inside my bird cage, hanging way up high. I like to swing upon my perch and sing my little song. But there's a cat that's after me and won't let me alone. I tore a putty cat a-tweeping up on me. I did, I tore a putty cat as plain as he could be.
I am that great big battle cat, Sylvester is my name. I only have one aim in life, and that is very plain. I want to catch that little bird and eat him right away. But just as I get close to him, this is what he'll say. I taught a putty cat creeping upon me. You bet he saw a putty cat. That putty cat is me.
Putty cat is very bad, he sneaks up from behind. I don't think I would like it if I knew what's on his mind. I have a strong suspicion that his plans for me aren't good. I am inclined to think that he would eat me if he could.
I'd like to eat that sweetie pie when he leaves his cage. But I can never catch him. It throws me in a rage. You bet I'd eat that little bird if I could just get near. But every time that I approach, this is all I hear.
I tore a putty cat that's weeping up on me. I did, I tore a putty cat as wet as he could be. And when I sing that little song, my mistress knows he's back. She grabs her broom and brings it down upon Sylvester's back. So listen, you bad putty cat, let's both be friends, you see. My mistress will not chase you if you sing this song with me. Come on now, like a good cat.
Oh, all right. Suffering succotash.
I tore a putty cat that's creeping up on me. I tore a putty cat as plain as he could be.
Now, thanks for listening. It's tubetalk1@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.